Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and today's show is titled One Mind. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. I understand that some of you are not aware that you can easily access these answers on my website, so I encourage you to visit the site where you can also ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. We encourage and welcome your questions. Today's guest is Dr. Larry Dawsey, a distinguished physician deeply rooted in the scientific world and yet an internationally influential advocate of the role of mind in health and the role of spirituality in healthcare, something I'm a great believer in. Upon graduating with honors from the University of Texas, Dr. Dawsey worked as a pharmacist while earning his MD degree from Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. Before completing his residency in internal medicine, he served as battalion surgeon in Vietnam, where he was decorated for valor. Dr. Dawsey helped establish the Dallas Diagnostic Association, the largest group of internal medicine practitioners in that city, and was chief of staff of Medical City Dallas Hospital in 1982. The author of 9 books, including One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters, which is what I want to discuss with him today. The primary quality of all of Dr. Dawsey's work is scientific legitimacy, with an insistent focus on what the data shows. As a result, his colleagues in medical schools and hospitals all over the country trust him, honor his message, and continually invite him to share his insights with them as he has lectured all over the world. In his 1989 book, Recovering the Soul, he introduced the concept of non-local mind, mind unconfined by the brain and body, mind spread infinitely throughout space and time. Since then, non-local mind has been adopted by many leading scientists as an emerging image of consciousness, which provides a legitimate foundation for the merging of spirit and medicine. Dr. Larry Dawsey, welcome to the show, Larry.
Dave, it's great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Hey, I'd love to have you here. I read your book, One Mind, and I really liked it. Now, you have clearly come to the conclusion that we as humans are really a mind or consciousness which can exist outside the body. So today I want to discuss 3 things with you. What do you mean by us being part of one mind? Why you believe this to be the case, and 3, why you believe it's important. So let's begin with, what do you mean by one mind? What's the nature of this one mind?
Well, I think the place to start is to see what we've done back in the 20th century with our view of what the mind is. We literally took it apart into so many pieces, it's kind of hard to keep up with them. Most people will know the terms, the unconscious, the preconscious, the subconscious, and this sort of thing. And there were other views of the mind, such as ego, id, superego, and all of this sort of thing. And also, anybody who has had any contact with biology or physiology in college or after college in professional work will know that the going idea is that consciousness is limited to the brain. It's made by the brain, and it's confined to the brain and body and to the present moment. I just happen to think that those ideas don't accommodate the facts from one personal experience that many people could point to, and also something else that's really important, experimental evidence. I think in order to accommodate the evidence, we're going to have to put the mind back together. I think we've been looking down the wrong end of the telescope, taking the mind apart, and what I'm trying to do is put it back together. This is not a new radical idea that consciousness is united and collective. This idea really goes back 3,000 years to something called the Akashic Records. Plato talked about a common consciousness. It ricochets through the scientific record recently with some of the great physicists in the 20th century proclaiming that consciousness was unitary. And so what I want to do is to say that this may sound new agey and like a radical wild idea to people who bump into it for the first time, but this goes really far back in human history and Western civilization as well as Eastern civilization. And it comes out at the other end recently being approved of and endorsed by some of the greatest scientists of the 21st century.
Now, what's the nature of this? It exists everywhere. It's omnipresent. It's all knowing. It's all loving. It's all caring. What is this thing we call one mind?
Well, one mind includes all individual minds, but it's sort of like an umbrella that is inclusive of the individual lesser expressions of it. I really follow some of the Eastern traditions in trying to define the one mind. It's what makes our individual thoughts and cognition possible. One mind is part of consciousness. Consciousness is what makes our awareness possible. I simply don't think that there's an adequate definition for what consciousness really is. If there is, I haven't come across it. We all struggle with definitions of consciousness, but consciousness is something I think is indefinable. It makes our cognition, our emotions, attitudes, thoughts, and so on possible. But really getting our minds around consciousness, I think, is something really very difficult to do.
Yeah, there's so clearly...
go ahead.
As you point out in your book, there is no scientific theory on consciousness.
No, and I think that that's a very helpful thing to admit up front. You know, I've spent most of my professional life dialogues with materialists and physicalists who think that they have nailed down what consciousness is. I simply don't think that's true. There is no scientific theory of consciousness. We don't know how it could even be possible for anything physical like the brain to produce consciousness. And so I think it's very healthy right from the get-go to admit the mystery and the great unknowns in this discussion.
Yeah. In life, we appear to be separate beings and alone. But in reality, separateness is only an illusion. And at death, we return to the fold. Is that kind of how you see it?
Yeah, it really is. I think there are several lines of evidence that point to this. I'll just take one, which is acknowledged by 15 million Americans currently, who say that they have had a near-death experience. If you look at the common report from these people, they come back with something that's almost unbelievable. They say that they have a simultaneous experience that they are individuals. Their sense of personhood is retained. But at the same time, they describe being caught up in something utterly transcendent that is majestic, wonderful, inexpressible, beyond words, which is a sense of unity and connectivity with everything there is. So this sounds paradoxical, and I suppose it is. These people come back with a profound sense of individuality and personhood, but at the same time, this transcendent, majestic, awe-inspiring, joy-producing sense of being one with everything. I think we have to take these experiences seriously. For one thing, they're so darn common. And secondly, they fit with the experiments that have been done and by the hundreds in consciousness research showing the same sort of unity that exists on this side of the veil.
You know, love is an interesting concept. And you say in your book, which I really like, that the opposite of love, which most people would say was hate, is not really hate, but it's individuality or separateness. Do you see love as maybe the desire for unity? You think that's what it is?
Well, I think that is a pretty good definition of it. This idea that the opposite of love is not hate, but it's individuality, I think is a profound observation. And I'm not against individuality in the sense of personhood, and I think a sense of self is very important as we mature as young people. If you try to short-circuit healthy psychological growth and leap right into this idea of spiritual connectivity and unity, you can really make a mess of things. I think that what we want to do is to mature as individuals in a healthy way and develop a sense of personhood and individuality, but we don't want to stop there. I think that's where the game really starts getting interesting, when we begin to need and want and desire to transcend this sense of individuality. I think we're making a mess of things in our world by focusing on individuality exclusively. It's given rise to an epidemic, in my judgment, of greed and selfishness, which really threatens our environment. So when we talk about the benefits of the one mind view, you know, there's some really practical things we can talk about, which is preserving our sense of responsibility for what goes on environmentally in this world.
Yeah,
I believe that without a sense of connectivity and unity and love and compassion, we're not going to be able to do very well in terms of meeting the great challenges that we face environmentally.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, let me go back for a second to your NDE comment. You know, when people have NDEs, near-death experiences, they get this feeling of love, and it seems to be an overriding emotion in all of these NDEs. Do you suppose that's because we desire to rejoin our source, and when we transition from the earth plane to the spiritual plane, we simply notice this huge difference in that feeling?
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to express it. The way I have a thinking about it is that the boundaries separating individuals in terms of bodies and minds just simply are done away with when people make their transition. And I think that science has a lot to answer for, because it has assured us that, for one thing, that since the brain makes consciousness, so it said, when the brain dies, nothing's left. Everything is annihilated. NDE experiences say that's not true. Also, science has said that consciousness and mind are absolutely individual. They do not operate beyond the boundaries of the brain and body. So you can forget all of this mystical nonsense about unity and connectivity and oneness. Well, the NDE experiences absolutely shatter that sort of reasoning. And, one thing that I think that we ought to insert here is that we're not dependent solely on near-death reports to craft this idea of the one mind. It comes out of thousands of experiments in consciousness research, which, in spite of the fact that a lot of skeptics just refuse to look at this information, it's there and it's not going away. And it gives us a really new take on what consciousness looks like in terms of unity and connectivity. And you're exactly right, Dave, that part of this awareness absolutely involves compassion and a sense of love.
This one mind, are animals part of it?
I have a large section in the book devoted to this question, because I'm an animal lover for one thing, and I think it's important to acknowledge that we're not talking just about human experiences here. I don't think there's any compelling evidence that consciousness is confined to human beings. I think it spills over into the animal kingdom. And if you look at the behaviors of groups of animals, herds of animals, flocks of birds, and schools of fish and so on, as I talk about in the book, you can't explain how they behave without bringing in this idea of a common consciousness. The information in these large groups of birds, fish, and animals can't get around quick enough by sight and sound and so on to accommodate how they behave simultaneously in these huge groups. So I think that there's enormous evidence suggesting that the one-mind idea spills over from the human domain into the animal domain.
Yeah. Do you remember Lawrence Anthony? He was the guy who spent his life taking care of and saving the elephants over in Zulu in South Africa, and I think he died about. I think it was in March. I mean, it was pretty recently. And when he died,
his funeral or something like that.
Exactly. He died, and they had this big preserve, and he was living in next to the preserve. His house was next to the preserve. And when he died, the elephants, some of them walked as long as 12 hours to come to his house, his home. And they stayed there as if they were grieving for about 2 days, and then they left. I mean, to me, that's, one, it's staggering. And,
well,
and how they would know, unless your theory of one mind is correct, you couldn't explain it.
I remember, Dave, when I first came across that story, I was stopped dead in my tracks. I'd already written my book, and I thought, gee, I wish that story had surfaced before I put my book to bed. I would have used it. It's a profound example, in my judgment, of the ability of consciousness to bridge between species. There's a lot of research in interspecies communication these days that suggests the same sort of thing. You've just given us one of the best examples out there about this.
Yeah, it's amazing. How about plants? Are plants, are they conscious?
Yeah, I think there's a gradation of consciousness from human beings on down to the rocks.
Yeah.
We start out, with what we recognize as consciousness in the human species, and it gets refined and less potent as we go down in terms of biological simplicity. But I can't imagine anything that is totally unconscious. One reason I would say that is that there are dozens of studies now that show that people can use their loving, compassionate intentions to affect the growth rates of bacteria in growing in test tubes. These studies are quite numerous now. Bacteria have the ability to respond to human intentions, and so I think this is one way of answering your question of whether or not anything can be totally unconscious. I rather doubt that, and I think these studies that have been done in laboratories with enormous specificity give an answer that we can communicate not only with plants, but with things that are much, much simpler in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, just so the listeners understand what we're saying, we're not saying that our bodies and the mineral bodies and the plant bodies are necessarily conscious. It's that there's consciousness is embedded within them, and that makes them appear conscious.
I think that's a good way of saying it.
And which basically says that the whole universe is probably conscious, which is what I believe.
I'm with you there. I'm not saying that rocks and microbes are conscious to the same degree,
right?
In the same elegance that human beings are, but that consciousness knows no stopping place when you begin to go down into simpler realms of the biological kingdom.
Yeah, I, you know, I, this, I, I know you've read Helena Blavatsky, you know, the mystic writings, you know, the secret doctrine and Isis Unveiled, and I have too. And and she, you know, her view is that, you know, we're consciousness is in an evolutionary state, and you start with nothing. I guess you start with a blank sheet. And then, and a blank sheet has no instincts, it has no nothing. And then, and maybe that consciousness is what is in minerals. And then it works its way up to plants and then lower life animals, higher life animals, us. And then it just keeps going. And we don't know a lot about where it keeps going, but it does keep going.
Yes, that reflects my view. And actually, Ken Wilber, the transpersonal psychologist, wrote a book about this a few years back. Actually, he begins with the divine, whatever term we ascribe to the divine, whether it's God or Goddess or Allah or the Absolute. And he talks about a process of devolution, where the divine consciousness begins to filter down into organisms of less complexity, human beings down to animals, to plants, to microbes, and so on. And then, as he reverses that and talks about the transition from devolution to evolution, where we get the backward readout of the devolution process, where things began to evolve back toward the divine and the absolute. And I think that we're seeing evidence of that currently.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. We're talking to Larry Dossey, who is the author of One Mind. Let's talk a little bit about how we know that this mind, you know, that there is one mind, or why you think that there is, and you know, ESP is certainly one key element of why that is, and ESP, you know, involves things like remote viewing, precognition, contact with the dead through mediums and clairvoyance, et cetera, et cetera. And all these phenomena relate to our consciousness receiving and or transmitting information without going through our five senses, right? And that's what's different.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of these things, and we can't do it what you've done in your book justice here on a short radio show. So I encourage everybody to read your book One Mind. But let's talk about some of the things. Now, we can skip remote viewing because we had Russell Targ on two weeks ago, and we covered that subject pretty well. And if anybody missed that, they can go on iHeartRadio and hear some really interesting discussions there. But you are a twin, as I understand it. So let's talk about some telepathy and telesomatic events that occur with twins.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, because that's probably my, being an identical twin, that's probably my favorite chapter in the book. My brother and I grew up experiencing simultaneous thoughts at a great distance from each other, and sometimes we even share physical symptoms at a distance. And to compound my interest in this, I'm married to a twin. My wife Barbara and her fraternal twin brother have had identical experiences as my brother and I had. So I've been surrounded by this twin thing for all of my life. And when my brother and I were experiencing these things growing up, we didn't think there was anything strange about it. We just called it twin stuff. And I had no idea that this was an area of active research in the consciousness research domain. And so what happens is that people who are compassionate and emotionally bonded with one another, as my twin brother and I were, even at a distance, can share thoughts and physical symptoms and even physical signs without any kind of sensory transaction whatsoever. Now, there's an entire book about this. If any listeners are interested in this sort of thing, the book is called Twin Telepathy, and it's a book full of these documented cases. I was fascinated by one of these, and I wrote about it in my book, and it had to do with four-year-old twin girls in northern Spain And just to make a long story short, one day the father took one of these little girls off to see the grandparents tens of kilometers away. The other little twin girl didn't want to go. She wanted to stay home and help her mother with household chores. Unfortunately, in doing so, she touched a red-hot iron and erupted in about half of her palm with a huge second-degree burn, a big old blister. As it turned out, tens of kilometers away at the same time, her twin sister erupted in a second-degree burn on the same hand, in the same pattern, in the same place on the palm. And this was all documented by a team of researchers from the University of Madrid who got wind of this and went and did studies and tests on these two little girls. Now, what do you do with a story like that? I hear skeptics all the time say, well, that was just one of those funny coincidences. I just can't go there. I mean, there's a point at which coincidence just doesn't satisfy. And these little girls were put through several tests by the psychologists. For example, when one was in the attic and one was in the basement, when the psychologists would stimulate one of the little girls, like tapping on her knee with the reflex hammer, the other little girl up in the attic would respond in the same way. Now, this is weird stuff. I don't know how you accommodate this kind of experimental finding without saying that there's some sort of one mind going on between these little girls. There's no other option that easily comes to mind in my judgment except to say, well, everybody's lying and this was just a case of fraud and nothing happened. I can't go there. There are too many of these cases that have been elegantly interviewed and tested by scholars.
Yeah.
So this is called telesomatic events. Telesomatic comes from Latin words meaning the distant body. It's as if one person has another body reflected in the twin, for example, as in this case. But the thing that seems to make these things go on, Dave, you have mentioned already, it's a sense of love and caring and compassion. Not all twins demonstrate this. Only about 20% of identicals demonstrate these kinds of events. And it invariably is twins who really enjoy being twins and who feel emotionally close to one another. All twins don't. They can have problems individuating and developing their own sense of self. And so for some twins, the last thing they'd want to do would be to demonstrate this sort of togetherness.
Right.
But about 20% of them do show this.
But, are you part of that 20%, your brother?
Yes. As a matter of fact, my twin brother and I still demonstrate this sort of thing every once in a while. So,
can you give us an example of what some of the odd things, odd things that you did?
Yeah, well, I would be up in the mountains in the Rocky Mountains wilderness area, and my brother would be down in Central Texas, 1,000 miles away. I would take a tumble and bruise my lower leg at a certain point, and he would break out in a bruise at the same time on the same location without any trauma whatsoever back in Texas. That would just be a classic, typical
that's
example.
Amazing. He probably said, hey, what are you doing? You know, take care of me, for Pete's sake.
Ouch. Be careful, would you?
Get it out.
So...
And you mentioned earlier that there was other connections, and I wanted to I just wanted to touch on that, and connections between humans and animals, and we talked a little bit about that with the elephant and such like that, and plants.
Right.
But the other thing that you mentioned, and you didn't go into a lot of detail, but I just thought we'd say that we have the human mind can interface with complex machines like random number generators and simple machines like dice, and it's been some amazing things. John and Dunn did some really interesting stuff in that area. I believe you mentioned that in the book.
Well, that's exactly right. Dr. Robert John and Brenda Dunn at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory for 30 years, three decades, did a series of experiments that are known as random number generator influence. And what happens is that when people set their minds or intentions in a certain direction, these random number generators, which are just fancy computers that randomly spit out equal numbers of zeros and ones, they will begin to depart from randomness, and they will drift into the direction of the intention of the person sitting in front of them. Actually, this gets really strange because they have put the operators now hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away, and the distance from the random number generator doesn't matter. Space is simply not an issue here. And to make matters even stranger, they can let the random number generator run, and then later have the individual try to push it in one direction or another in favor of ones or zeros. And then when they go back and look at the record, they find out that the random number generator, which has already presumably done its thing and should be spitting out equal numbers of zeros and ones, has actually performed in correlation with their intentions that came later. So there's so-called time displacement here. These are powerful indicators that there's something about consciousness that just doesn't give a whit about time and space. This is only one category of experiments that point in these directions. Well, actually, it is now the case that there are six areas of consciousness research in which the odds against a chance explanation for what happens in these experiments are over a billion against one. There's something called presentiment experiments, precognition experiments, Gonfield studies, the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton, random number generator influences, which we just mentioned, and remote viewing experiments, which Dr. Targ talked about, you mentioned. And if you combine all of the odds against chance of these six areas, what you get are combined odds against chance of 10 to the 54th power against one.
That's this about exceeds as many molecules in the universe. That's amazing.
Well, this is a number that is inconceivable. It exceeds the number of known particles in the universe. So when we talk about the evidence favoring this idea that consciousness can operate outside of time and space in a way that flaunts boundaries and separation, we're not talking about just a study here and there. We're talking about studies now that defy odds against chance that are just astronomical.
And the other thing in the book you point out, which I think is should be interesting to the listeners, is that you note that extraordinary things happen to most people in their lives. You know, like deciding, you know, when a bridge is going to collapse, you decide you're going to go another way. Or when an airplane disaster goes down, you decided that morning that you're not feeling well or you want to do something else, and you avoid it. You know? And so this isn't something that just happens to these few people. It really happens to all of us to some extent.
Yes. You know, there are these sort of prodigies, I guess we could call them, who seem to have a talent for picking up on this sort of thing. And so they really stand out, and these are the subjects that researchers really like to get their hands on. But most of us aren't prodigies in this way. But if we pay attention, most people will be able to identify every once in a while something strange that is out of the ordinary, that looks as if their consciousness was functioning outside their brain and their body. I think one reason to have public discussions about this, Dave, is to give people a kind of permission to pay attention to this sort of thing. there really is a stigma still in our culture about going public talking about this sort of thing. This is one reason why doctors are so hesitant to even acknowledge this sort of thing, even though they see stuff like this unusually in their practice. So we need to talk about this, make it public, and emphasize the empirical evidence that favors this sort of thing.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And more people are doing this. And you're right. A lot of doctors, one of the things you said in your book, and you've obviously had a chance to talk to these doctors, is that most all of them have had these things that they simply can't explain, one incident or another. And they just, you know, I'm sure they remember it. They keep it to themselves, but they don't talk about it because, you know, we like to badmouth and make fun of anybody who's a little different and thinks differently from us.
You know, I had an interesting experience along those lines. About 5 years ago, I was asked to give a talk to a group of Harvard docs who were gathered together for a continuing medical education course. And I was asked to talk about some of these issues. And I did so with great hesitation because I thought, you know, they're going to be throwing tomatoes by the time I finish this. But I talked about it anyway, and I shared with them my experiences with precognitive dreams in my medical practice of patients I would see the next day that would conform to the dream the night before. So I sort of made a fool out of myself by talking about these things and acknowledging my experiences. And then in the Q&A session, when I thought that, you know, it would all go south, they started sharing with me their experiences. And this was absolutely fascinating. I had given them permission to go in this direction by confessing my own experiences. And so they felt safe. They knew I wasn't going to criticize them. Right. And one female internist stood up in the middle of this crowd and said, "Well, I get numbers in my dreams." She said, "I dream my patient's specific laboratory results before I even order the lab tests." And so it went from there. And I thought, who knows what doctors are really sitting on if they had permission to be public without being shamed? You know, we would have a whole new view of what the practice of medicine looks like, probably.
That's absolutely amazing. Let's move on into implications. And you're saying that our consciousness is not resident in our brain or body, but transcends it, which implies consciousness came into existence before our body did and will remain in existence after our body dies, which simply means that there's life after death. And when you couple that concept with the apparent extreme order of the universe, then it implies purpose. Is there a purpose to existence that you see?
Absolutely. I think there's meaning and pattern and purpose that reveals itself to us if we open ourselves to it. We can hide our eyes and deny that there's purpose and meaning and direction, which is what we've done pretty much most of the 20th century in terms of focusing on a materialistic idea of consciousness. And I think that that's wrong-headed. I think that the most glorious and majestic implication of this one-mind idea is immortality. And I think we are justified in putting the idea of the soul back on the table. And the way we get there is to say that consciousness behaves in ways that are non-local in real life. And non-local is just a fancy word for infinite. It appears that if our minds can operate infinitely, that they're beyond time and space. And so what does that mean? If something is infinite in time, it's immortal and it's eternal. So by focusing on these studies and experiments that show that consciousness is infinite or non-local, basically what we've done is to resurrect the soul. I think that this is the greatest contribution that this entire area makes to human welfare. As a physician, I believe that the fear of death and total annihilation has caused more suffering for humans than all the physical diseases combined. And I think this idea of non-locality of consciousness is a great cure for this terrible disease, which is fear of annihilation with physical death. So I think that we have hit a rich payload here when we talk about non-local consciousness in the one mind, and it has to do with immortality.
You know, I look at an individual life as we have a purpose to learn something in this life. We all have something slightly different to learn. I mean, we're all learning the same stuff, but you know, at any given life, we're learning something slightly different. But in the longer view, if you look at what does existence mean, and is there a purpose behind existence? I see it as the perfection of the soul, and that we are spending eternity. I mean, if you think about it, you know, eternity is a long time. You get bored with eternity if you got nothing to do, right? So you need to have a purpose. You need to be doing something that you'll never complete and always will be interesting. And I see that as the perfection of the soul. And if we looked at some of these spirits, I believe, that have existed for a long, long time, we'd look at them, and if we could look at them, we would say, now that is a perfect spirit. But that pure spirit would probably say back to us, no, I'm not perfect. I can still do this or that or this. And it's one of those things that goes forever. And it's a fascinating concept to me. That's my view of the world. I don't know how you see it, but that's my view.
Well, that really rings true to me. I'm sitting here thinking about a quotation from the American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said that if everything was consistent in life, then a great soul would simply have nothing to do. And I think what he was saying is that if there was not room for ongoing perfection, as you say, we would all get bored. There's nothing about reports from people who've had near-death experiences that suggest that anybody is bored over there.
Right.
And that's encouraging, I think.
I agree. You know, I look at the world today, and I, as you do, and you see everybody at everybody, and it seems like prejudice is the biggest issue we have, and we talk about it here in the United States between virtually every group, but if you look around the world, you know, you see the obvious Middle East, where you got the Sunnis and the Shiites and such, and you see certainly before, but I'm sure the prejudice is still there in Ireland and a lot of other places between the Catholics and the Protestants and the Asians have their problems, and we have plenty of ours here. I think prejudice right now is the big issue that the world is working on, that the spiritual world is trying to get humanity at this period of time to deal with and understand. I don't know what your view is on that, but you know, when I look at the problems, it just seems like prejudice is the big one. And if we could recognize what you're putting out as, hey, we're all one, you know, it just seems to me that it goes a long ways to defeating the concept of I'm better, you're different, you're this, you're that. It just seems to me that it would go a long way to working that problem.
I couldn't agree more. And again, I think that this idea of oneness and unity is maybe the only thing that's going to save us, because if we cannot overcome the sense of tribalism and hyper-individuality, I think there's no way that we're going to break the cycle of greed and selfishness and sheer destructiveness that we visited on the only home we have. You know, we do have some avatars, some instructors who have overcome this idea of individuality. I'll call it pathological individuality. I wrote in the book about something called the overview effect. And this is the experience that a lot of cosmonauts and astronauts have had coming back from the moon to the Earth and being overwhelmed with a sense of epiphany, looking at the big blue marble that is the Earth with no obvious boundaries in it. Edgar Mitchell, who was the lunar module pilot, I think, on Apollo 14,
right,
really describes this life-changing, transformative experience that he had in outer space, looking at the Earth from afar, seeing no boundaries and being overcome with a sense of unity and oneness and compassion and love. And when he got back, this didn't go away. He founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is a great group devoted to consciousness research and human transformation. I look to that sort of thing to show us that it is possible for us to achieve this sort of realization of oneness and for it to make a transformative difference. We're not talking about just evanescent psychological experiences here. For people who really deeply feel this connectivity, it is life-changing, and it can change our fate as a species on this Earth, in my judgment.
Yeah, I think so too, and I find it an absolutely fascinating topic, and I'll tell you, I'm really pleased that you went and went out on a limb in not just writing the book, because you've written other books before this on the subject, but the fact that you're going around and as a scientist who looks at the data and you've been there, and I lived in science for a long time too. And the outside world thinks that science, really, that's all they do is they look at the data and it takes them somewhere. But that's not really what happens in one. Science,
right.
Science doesn't just look at the data. Science is full of prejudices, and you have to break that mold, and you need to do that. And I know you're trying to do it, and I love it that you are.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm dancing as fast as I can, and I'm really hopeful. I often compare what I see today in medical schools and in the training of young physicians compared to what things looked like when I was going through back in the dark ages when my hair was black. It's really daylight and dark. You know, these kids coming out of medical school now really don't struggle with profound materialism and physicalism that was just poisonous to people of my generation. So I think that there is room for hope. One of the things that encourages me is that over 50% of the graduating classes in medical school these days are made up of young women who just do not struggle with these ideas to the extent that young men have traditionally done. So I'm hopeful, and I'm also delighted to say that a lot of this consciousness research that you and I have been alluding to has to do with healing, the use of compassionate, loving intentions to change the biology of somebody in need. So there's a lot of hot stuff going on with consciousness research in medicine. So I'm hopeful, as I say.
Yeah. How can people find out more about some of the things you're doing? I know you give a lot of talks and such. How can people find out?
I have a website people can keep up with. It's LarryDawseyMD.com. Actually, I have another book out that just came out this week. It's called What is Consciousness? And it's co-written with Gene Houston and Dr. Irvin Laszlo. I have a lengthy one-third of the book devoted to this idea of the one mind. And if people want an up-to-date version of this view, then that would be a place to look. What is consciousness?
Okay. And that's. Excuse me. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. This is, we're talking with Dr. Larry Dossey, and that Dossey is spelled D-O-S-S-E-Y, so that you can look it up and make sure you you get the right easily get the right place. Hey, Larry, it has been great talking to you. I really appreciate you you coming on the show. You're doing great things, and I love the stuff you're doing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the work you do too. Can I close with just a few lines of poems?
Absolutely.
Well, this is from Hafiz, a Persian poet in the 14th century. He sort of summed up the one mind this way. He said, "Let's go deeper, for if we do, our spirits will embrace and interweave. Our union will be so glorious that even God will not be able to tell us apart."
Very good. Thanks so much, Larry.
Best to you. Let's do it again, David.
Okay, sounds good. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.